around here.
There's another one, Braddock, you have a whole town named Braddock.
Yeah.
I visited his grave in eighth grade.
Braddock Avenue, and
yeah.
This is an interesting story.
Yeah.
As is, you know, George Washington and being in this area, and a lot of the names. Again, a lot of the French and Indian war names.
Most of the streets downtown, and we're not going to talk about all of them, but Stanwyck Street, you know, Fort Duquesne, Fort Pitt, Forbes Avenue, Ross Street, I believe. I mean, they're all French and Indian War figures.
There really is so much that you just don't realize.
Yeah, that's the goal of our show.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, thanks.
Thank you.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
I let go of trying to control things that I had no control over, and that helped me find peace of mind.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
I was constantly stressed and worried. Now I approach each day with joy and gratitude.
In Al-Anon, families and friends of alcoholics find new ways to heal from the effects of a loved one's drinking.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. For information, call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
WRCT, the inside from way out.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We have a large armada, flotilla, call it whatever you want, heading toward Iran right now, even larger than what we had in Venezuela.
After weeks of President Trump threatening to attack Iran, U.S. and Iranian officials are in Oman for talks today. We'll speak to a journalist covering Iran for the Washington Post on Wednesday, and 300 of her colleagues were laid off at the Washington Post, which is owned by Amazon's billionaire founder, Jeff Bezos. And we'll speak with Karen Attia, a former Post columnist and editor who was fired over social media posts following the assassination of Charlie Kirk. Plus, we talked to Omar Shakir, who's resigned as Human Rights Watch's Israel and Palestine director after HRW blocked the release of a report on the right of return for Palestinians. We'll also talk to the former head of Human Rights Watch, Ken Roth, about the controversy and Gaza overall. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Senate leaders said Thursday they expect funding for the Department of Homeland Security to lapse at the end of next week after Republican Majority Leader John Thune rejected demands by Democrats for new restrictions on federal immigration officers. He called them unrealistic. Democrats had proposed 10 so-called guardrails against abuses by federal agents. The list includes an end to racial profiling, prohibiting agents from entering private property without a judicial warrant, requirements agents wear body cameras and unique ID numbers, access to attorneys for those detained, and an end to raids near medical centers, schools, churches, polling places, courts, and other sensitive sites. Without a deal by February 13th, Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Customs and Border Protection will no longer receive government funding, though officers will continue to work without pay since they're exempted from furloughs. Other agencies, including FEMA, the Coast Guard, and the TSA, would also be affected. On Wednesday, the two Democratic lawmakers, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, drew fire from their party's base when they appeared to backtrack on a demand that federal agents should not cover their faces to conceal their identities. Here in New York, a dozen Columbia University students and faculty members were arrested Thursday for blocking traffic on Broadway outside campus in protest of Trump's immigration crackdown and to demand Columbia enact stronger protections for its international students. Protesters wore matching shirts emblazoned with the words Sanctuary Campus Now.
University should be the first line of defense against fear and repression, not a testing ground for it. If a campus cannot protect its own students and scholars, what does it stand for?
In Italy, protests have continued opposing the deployment of ICE agents to join the U.S. delegation for the Winter Olympics in Milan, where hundreds of protesters gathered for the opening ceremony today.
They're murderers, and they killed a lot of people, innocent people, and they've done bad things that I don't approve of, and we don't approve of, and we don't want them here, even just for the Olympics.
In the United Kingdom, Prime Minister Keir Starmer faces a growing political storm over his decision in 2024 to appoint Peter Mandelson as U.S. ambassador, despite his connections to Jeffrey Epstein. In September, the tabloid newspaper The Sun published a trove of emails revealing Mandelson urged Epstein to fight for early release from prison after his 2008 conviction for procuring a child for prostitution, writing, "Your friends stay with you and love you," unquote. Starmer was grilled by members of the House of Commons Wednesday, where he insisted Mandelson lied during the vetting process, implying he barely knew Epstein.
Mandelson betrayed our country, our parliament, and my party. Mr. Speaker, he lied repeatedly to my team when asked about his relationship with Epstein before and during his tenure as ambassador. I regret appointing him. If I knew then what I know now, he would never have been anywhere near government.
The Prime Minister apologized to Epstein's survivors. Opposition leaders in the Conservative and Liberal Democrat parties have called for a no-confidence vote for Prime Minister Starmer. Here in New York, the chair of the White Shoe law firm, Paul Weiss, has resigned after emails released by the Justice Department showed he'd been a guest at the mansion of the late sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein and exchanged friendly emails with Epstein on a number of occasions. Breitkarp's sudden resignation Wednesday came after he spent 18 years as chairman of Paul Weiss, which represents corporate giants including Amazon, ExxonMobil, and the NFL. Last March, the law firm was widely criticized after it pledged $40 million in pro bono legal services to issues President Trump has championed while eliminating DEI programs, all in response to Trump's executive order threatening to block the firm from representing clients before the federal government. Brad Karp is also a board member at New York Presbyterian and Mount Sinai Hospitals. In response, the New York State Nurses Association called for his removal, writing, quote, "Can board members like this be trusted to protect health care for New Yorkers?" unquote. Some 15,000 New York City nurses have been on strike since January 12th. On Thursday, 13 members of the Nurses Association were arrested for refusing to leave the headquarters of a major hospital trade association in Manhattan. In South Africa, activists with the Global Samud Flotilla have announced plans for the largest ever direct action seeking to break Israel's siege of the Gaza Strip by bringing humanitarian aid to the Palestinian territory. Organizers said Thursday they hope to mobilize thousands of people from over 100 countries in a coordinated nonviolent response against, quote, genocide, siege, mass starvation, and the destruction of civilian life in Gaza.
We will sail with this time thousands of participants, including more than 1,000 doctors, nurses, health professionals, over 100 boats.
Mandla Mandela is a member of South Africa's parliament, an organizer with the Global Samud Flotilla, and the grandson of the late South African leader Nelson Mandela. He's planning to join the next flotilla when it sets sail in March. Last October, he was abducted at sea by Israeli forces during a previous attempt to sail into Gaza carrying urgently needed humanitarian aid.
As a collective across the globe, we can isolate apartheid Israel, collapse it and bring it to its knees, just as we did to apartheid South Africa. We therefore want to take this opportunity, comrades and friends, to call on the entire global community. Registration is now open for Mission 2026.
The United Nations has warned of a humanitarian collapse in Cuba due to Trump's oil blockade on the island. Venezuelan oil was a lifeline for Cuba, which has been devastated by decades of U.S. economic sanctions. Since the U.S. abduction of the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, Venezuela's oil exports to Cuba have run dry as the Trump administration seeks to control Venezuelan oil reserves. Fuel shortages in Cuba have prompted longer hours of blackouts, including in Havana, while the cost of food and transportation skyrockets. Despite Trump's persistent threats, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel said Thursday he remains open to talks with Washington.
Cuba is willing to engage in dialogue with the United States, dialogue on any issue that needs to be discussed or debated. Under what conditions? Without pressure. Dialogue cannot take place under pressure.
This comes as Reuters reports the Mexican government's evaluating options to send fuel to Cuba to aid in the humanitarian crisis while attempting to avoid retaliatory tariffs from the Trump administration. In Sudan, the United Nations warns famine conditions are continuing to spread to more regions. Experts warn the rate of acutely malnourished children under the age of five has nearly doubled in Umbaru, located in Sudan's Darfur region. In another area of western Darfur, nearly a third of children are now suffering from acute malnutrition. Elsewhere, the Sudan Doctors Network reports at least 22 people were killed Thursday when RSF paramilitaries bombed the Al-Kuwait Hospital in South Kordofan State. Among the reported victims of the hospital's medical director and at least three other healthcare workers. Nigeria's government has deployed military forces to the western state of Kwara after gunmen reportedly massacred at least 170 people in the village of Woro Tuesday. More than 20 others were killed in a separate attack in the city of Katsina in northern Nigeria as gunmen went home to home targeting civilians. No groups claim responsibility. This is a resident of the state of Kwara.
As of now, nobody can locate their relatives. Right now, I am shedding tears because I can't find my children. And my eldest son came and informed me that he couldn't find his younger ones. He told me to run away for our safety, but I declined, telling him death is everywhere.
In response to recent attacks, the U.S. Africa Command confirmed Tuesday the Trump administration had deployed a small number of military troops to Nigeria. This comes as all 166 people abducted in an attack last month on a village and churches in northern Nigeria's Kaduna state have been rescued, according to the Christian Association of Nigeria. In Pakistan, at least 31 people were killed and dozens left wounded after a powerful explosion ripped through a Shia mosque in Islamabad during Friday prayers earlier today. Video shared on social media showed bloodied bodies surrounded by broken glass and debris on the floor of the mosque. Officials say 169 people were transferred to area hospitals. There's been no claim of responsibility but rumors of a suicide bomber. And new data released Thursday show U.S. layoffs rose in January to their highest level since the Great Recession of 2009. According to the firm Challenger Gray and Christmas, U.S. employers announced nearly 109,000 layoffs last month, up 205% from the previous month. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We're beginning today's show looking at new calls for the city of New York to release all files related to toxins released in the air when the World Trade Center Twin Towers collapsed in the 9/11 attack almost 25 years ago. The headline on Thursday's New York Daily News front page reads, Ground Zero Memo Shocker. City lawyers worried about toxins just after attack, but stayed silent. Today's cover of the Daily News reads, Release all 9/11 docs. Well, our own Juan Gonzalez closely covered this issue for the Daily News and Democracy Now! Beginning just after the 9/11 attacks and wrote about it in his book, Fallout, The Environmental Consequences of the World Trade Center Collapse. Juan, as I read these stories and the uncovered memo, I could only think about your groundbreaking reporting from Ground Zero at the time when everyone from the president to the New Jersey governor to the mayor at the time, Giuliani, said it's safe to go back to work.
Yes, Amy, and it really saddens me that 25 years later, what I tried to warn about in the series of articles that I wrote about the dangers, the health dangers in the future for people who were living in or working in Ground Zero have proven to be true. You know, that period of time was one of the toughest in my career because there were so many people who were basically attacking my reporting. Christy Todd Whitman herself, the EPA administrator, wrote an op-ed piece in the Daily News blasting me. Catherine Wild, who was then the head of the Partnership for New York City, the big business group of New York, accused me of engaging in Halloween pranks and this City Hall, the Giuliani administration, blasted me to my editors, and even my own editors then said, look, you got to take it easy. You can't back this stuff up. And I remember telling Ed Kozner, the editor-in-chief of the Daily News at that time, I said, Ed, I don't want 20 years later that thousands of people will be dying as a result of the fact that we didn't warn them about the dangers. And there's now more people have died as a result of illnesses contracted after the collapse of the World Trade Center than died on that day. And I just wanted to read quickly a little section that I wrote in the introduction to my book on this whole issue, which I think puts it in context. I wrote back then, the early blanket assurances that, and again, this was written within weeks of the collapse of the World Trade Center, the early blanket assurances that government officials issued were a grave mistake. And their continued defense of those assurances in the face of widespread public skepticism was inexcusable. Thousands of people may end up paying for that deception through unnecessary illness or premature death in the decades to come. In their rush to return New York City and Wall Street to business as usual, those short-sighted officials unwittingly paved the way for a second wave of victims from the World Trade Center tragedy. In scrutinizing the government response to the collapse, I am not suggesting that there was some secret conspiracy to hide the facts, or that anyone intentionally set out to mislead the people of New York. But I have no doubt that some officials saw what they wanted to see and irresponsibly chose to minimize or dismiss any post-collapse environmental threat. They did so for any number of reasons or combination of them, out of ignorance, in response to political pressures from superiors, or because they underestimated environmental threats from toxic releases, something that is all too common in the history of such disasters. Once ordinary citizens questioned their assurances, however, those officials closed ranks, dissembled, hid important information, and refused to listen or alter their policies. My aim here is to outline key lessons of this saga for the general public so that this kind of deception is not repeated should another catastrophe occur in the future. And now we are finding that they actually knew a lot more about the potential dangers than even I realized, because their own lawyers were telling them, look, we could be facing an onslaught of lawsuits as a result of our failure to provide people adequate information about the dangers that they faced. So it's really a sad day in terms of New York City government to realize that it's taken this long to uncover the facts.
You know, I said New Jersey governor. It was Christy Todd Whitman, who had been New Jersey governor, who, as you said, became EPA administrator and was assuring everyone everything was safe. And we're going to move on. But Juan, you should have won a Pulitzer Prize for your reporting. The Daily News would go on to win a Pulitzer Prize. But your editor at the time was forced out because of what you were saying at that time. I encourage people to check out this new documentary about Democracy Now. Steal this story, please, because there's a whole section on Juan's reporting on the toxins at Ground Zero and what people faced. I'm headed to Santa Barbara today for the International Film Festival there, where Steal the Story will play tonight and tomorrow, and has just won the Social Justice Award there. Juan, congratulations on your reporting, although what you were reporting on is continuing to play out today and is truly an extremely sad story about local officials, right up to the president, not protecting their own citizens and residents. We're going to stay on the media right now. In what's been described a bloodbath, the Washington Post has laid off more than 300 journalists, about 30% of all its employees, dismantling its sports, local news, and international coverage, including all of the newspaper's Middle East correspondents and editors. The Post's Ukraine reporter, Lizzie Johnson, wrote on X, quote, "I was just laid off by the Washington Post in the middle of a war zone," she wrote. From Ukraine. On Thursday, fired workers rallied outside the Washington Post office. This is a reporter, Ben Brash, who was fired Tuesday.
These layoffs are shameful.
Shame.
The fourth richest person in the world, Jeff Bezos, owns the Washington Post. He could run it at a loss for the rest of time, and yet he refuses. And instead, he's spending tens of billions of dollars buying a documentary from Melania Trump to curry favor with the President of the United States. When people show you who they are, believe them. Billionaires only get rich by stealing from us.
Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post in 2013. Last year, the paper lost over 250,000 digital subscribers after the paper announced it would not make an endorsement in the presidential race between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. Bezos's Amazon later donated $1 million to Trump's inaugural fund. We're joined right now by two guests. Karen Atiyah, former global opinion editor for The Washington Post, was fired last year over social media posts made after the killing of far-right activist Charlie Kirk. Nilu Tabrizi is an investigative reporter who closely covers Iran. She was just laid off from the Washington Post yesterday. Nilu, let's start with you. What's being termed a bloodbath. 300 employees of the Washington Post, about a third of the Washington Post. You write about Iran. Talk about what happened in Iran. Talk about what happened with the Middle East coverage overall and what's happened with all of your colleagues.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be here to discuss what happened at the Post. So our entire Middle East staff was laid off. Most of the international desk was dismantled as well. And this is something that we heard was coming down in the newsroom a few weeks ago. And we also heard that when this plan was presented to Peter Finn, who's the head of the international desk and mentor to many at the Post, he said to them he would rather be laid off than deal with this horrible gutting and reconstruction, as it was, phrased. So it's been incredibly depressing. Everybody is grieving, and it's a loss for our readers. It's a loss for everyone. And the way the company is framing, you know, that we want to focus more on national security, well, international reporters and national security, I mean, these two desks collaborate so much with each other. And so it's a deeply grim moment. And, you know, as a member of the Post Guild in the union at the Washington Post, we're lucky to have the Guild fight for us. But international staff, they're not members of the Guild. And even worse, there's so many local workers that we work with at the Post. We have local drivers, translators, reporters that collaborate with our bureau chiefs and with our correspondents. Those people are not protected in the same way that I am. And so it's incredibly awful. There's no words to describe the dismantling that's happening at the Post.
And Neil, I wanted to ask you, especially this whole issue of the international reporting, with so few U.S. Media companies still having even a skeleton staff of reporters reporting on affairs outside the United States. What does that turn the Washington Post into? And also, what does that say about the ability of the media in the U.S. to let people know in this country what's going on in the rest of the world?
Right. I mean, it's a complete disservice. I mean, we do this job because we want to be in service to the public. This is the main intention for so many of us. And taking the ability away to do this type of reporting, to communicate what's important, I mean, it's a disservice to our readership and to anyone who wants to engage in these issues. I mean, my last story that I did for the Post, which published on Monday, the day before I got laid off, was about the buildup that we're seeing of vessels of U.S. military equipment in the Persian Gulf. And potentially there might be some type of strike. And now the Post is not well placed to cover that. And it's incredibly heartbreaking.
Yeah, I'd like to bring Karen Atiyah into the conversation as well. Karen, your response to these layoffs and Jeff Bezos was, while they were happening, was actually in Paris at a haute couture week?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I joined the Post and specifically the opinion section right after Bezos bought the paper, so in about 2014, and I was, you know, there when we were kind of riding high, basically. We had not only Bezos cash, right, but we had the permission in a lot of ways to be able to be creative in order to be able to be swashbuckling provocative, and for most of my time, a good chunk of my time in the opinion section, I was the global opinions editor. And we had a direct mandate, basically, from Bezos saying that he wanted the Washington Post to be a global newspaper, that he wanted us to be the English-speaking newspaper that the rest of the world turned to. So that's why, you know, I got to work recruiting writers and building up that section of global writers, including Jamal Khashoggi, who was very brutally murdered in 2018. Jeff Bezos, we thought, shared the same values that we had, particularly when it came to international coverage and for standing up for journalists who weren't able to speak freely in their areas of the world. And now to see him butchering the Post, or at least, at the very least, partying in Paris and in Europe, while so many of my colleagues are being unceremoniously kicked out of their job at a time when America desperately needs to know what's going on in its own neighborhood and in the world. It's unconscionable, frankly.
And Karen Atiyah, you were the former global opinion editor for the Washington Post. You platformed many courageous voices, including Jamal Khashoggi, who would be murdered in the embassy in Turkey, and all the intelligence reports from the agencies of the United States government pointed the finger at a dear ally of President Trump, Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Your thoughts on your ousting? It was the time of the assassination of Charlie Kirk, but what you represented at the Post?
You know, what so much about this is breaks my heart still to this day. What breaks my heart is, yes, having the ability to give writers a home in times where they couldn't. And now when they ask, well, where can we be heard? Where can our voices go? And I can't in good conscience say that they have a safe place in the Washington Post anymore. You know, I think for me, you know, I was illegally, I will say, fired for posting very, you know, posting the facts about gun violence in this country, about race in this country, and basically, you know, fired for doing my job. But the signs are all there. The censoring of the opinion page when Bezos said that opinions that were outside of his scope of free markets and personal liberties, that was a red flashing sign that censorship and purging was going to come for the Washington Post. I tried to hold on for as long as I could and do the work that I was, you know, paid to do for as long as I could until I couldn't. I mean, I'm still continuing to fight that termination as well. So I think if anything, showing that we need to stand up to this purging is even more important. So I'm definitely fighting back with the assistance, not just the assistance, but the Guild has my back. So I'm grateful for that. But this is a bigger moment. There's a reason why this is an international news story. I think the Washington Post stands for a lot more than just a media company. It stands for a lot more than even just journalism, I would say. For a lot of people around the world, they're looking at the Washington Post as a proxy and a bellwether for what's happening to America and democracy, right? And when we are not able to even be able to freely cover our own neighborhoods, be able to freely cover the world, be able to, you know, under DC being under military occupation, basically, with the National Guard, we can't even retain a diverse set of journalists in a city that is very much immigrants, people of color. There are probably, at this point, less than maybe 30 black journalists left. I was the last black columnist left at the Washington Post, full-time staff opinions columnist left at the Washington Post. So the brazenness with which the destruction of the line of defense of journalism against oppression is just, it's as shameless on their end as it is cruel. And DC deserves better. This entire region deserves better. Journalism deserves better than a billionaire owner who decides that, you know, partying in Europe is more important than people's lives. The Washington Post deserves a better owner than this.
I wanted to ask Neil Tabrizi about this this enormous change in direction that Bezos has gone in with the Washington Post versus how he started, then his muzzling of the editorial page, and then his fawning after Trump with the financing of the Melania film. What is your sense of the enormity of this change? It's almost like a 180 degree turn on his part from where he started.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't say it better myself. It's a complete departure from the mission of the Post, and democracy dies in darkness. Well, now it's completely dark, and what do we have left?
That's the motto of the Washington Post.
Yes, that's the motto of the Washington Post. Exactly. And it's really, yeah, it's indescribable. And I really feel for my Post colleagues who now have to show up and work in a carcass of what this incredible institution was. The Post was such a special culture. It was different from any other newsroom I've worked in, where it was deeply collaborative. Desks were not competing for each other. Everyone was there for the same mission, which was to put out the best report. And they've completely dismantled that. And again, it's a deep disservice to any of our readers, to our public. And it shows the fragility of these institutions and how important it is to protect them, because with one fell swoop and a horrific layoff, 30-minute robotic meeting in which our publisher was not even present. We saw that our publisher, Will Lewis, was at some Super Bowl-related event. They didn't have the dignity to look us in the eye. You know, people got these mass emails, your job is eliminated.
You were told not to come to work yesterday.
We were all told not to come to work. We had an 8:30 a.m. Zoom, which in itself is inconscionable. And then after that, employees who even had, 27 plus years of service were told they lost their job in a one-line email where our publisher, again, was not present. This, again, really shows the lack of leadership at the Post.
Well, we're going to continue to cover the story and continue to cover the corporate media and remind people Democracy Now! Is independent. Nilu Tabrizi, just laid up from the Washington Post, will stay with us as we talk about Iran next. And Karen Attia, we thank you so much for joining us, former global opinion editor for the Washington Post. This is Democracy Now. When we come back, the talks in Oman around Iran between the United States and Iran. And then we'll talk about Gaza. Stay with us.
Nobody wants you, nobody cares. Nobody likes you, nobody dares. To exist in a greeting, a connecting glance. Life is just a jaded game to them. They will give it a chance. But you know, and I know, that the galaxies are all around us. And life will flow on as long as the grass grows and the water runs.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Iran. After weeks of escalating tensions, U.S. and Iranian officials have begun talks over Iran's nuclear program in Muscat, Oman today. Today's negotiations to stave off another conflict are the first between the two countries since President Trump ordered airstrikes against Iran's nuclear sites during Israel's 12-day war with Iran last June. Middle East Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner are participating in the talks, which are being mediated by Oman. The White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt told reporters Thursday that for President Trump, diplomacy is always his first option, whether dealing with allies or adversaries. But over the past month, President Trump has also openly called for regime change in Iran and described sending an armada of U.S. warships to the Persian Gulf. At the height of Iran's crackdown on popular protests in January, he threatened to attack Iran to support the protests. On Wednesday, Trump renewed his threat, speaking to NBC's Tom Yamas.
Should the supreme leader in Iran be worried right now?
I would say he should be very worried, yeah. He should be.
For more on the prospects of these negotiations and the tense situation on the ground in Iran, we continue with Nilu Tabrizi. She was the investigative reporter covering Iran for the Washington Post. They just laid her off yesterday in the mass layoff. We're also joined here in New York by Arang Keshavarzian, professor of Middle East and Islamic Studies at New York University, award-winning author of the books Bazaar and State in Iran and Making Space for the Gulf, Histories of Regionalism in the Middle East. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! We only have a few minutes at this moment, but we want to ask you about the significance of these talks, of President Trump's threat to attack Iran, and the possibility of diplomacy.
Thank you for having me. Yes, as you explained, this is a very strange and contradictory situation. On the one hand, there are these negotiations, first time in several months. It does seem both parties are interested. Donald Trump has repeated that he would like to have a negotiated settlement around the nuclear issue, but it comes right after 7 months of where the United States engaged a military attack against Iran, as you mentioned. But maybe more importantly, it's after a yet another cycle of a brave Iranian protesters taking to the streets in late December and January. That was yet again brutally repressed, with thousands killed, imprisoned, injured, and so on and so forth. So for both the Iranian state, but more importantly for Iranian people, it's very unclear what all of this portends, especially since it doesn't seem like these negotiations will go beyond the question of the nuclear program.
And Professor, I'm wondering, you're probably aware that Drop Site News is reporting that senior U.S. military officials have informed the leadership of a key U.S. ally in the Middle East that the president could authorize a U.S. attack this weekend. Wondering your assessment of this dual policy of Trump, on the one hand saying let's talk, on the other side amassing this armada again and threatening a direct attack.
Yeah, so there's echoes of obviously what happened in Venezuela these past few months. So you have this talk of negotiations, but all of these threats. But I also want to point out that we're in a moment where there's a real deep information war, where there are many interested parties, governments, and opposition groups that are trying to feed information, misinformation. It's a very confusing part. And it should be noted that for people inside Iran who are under still a internet blackout, it's very confusing. They don't know what pieces of information to believe, what not to believe. Is there a war on the horizon, or are these negotiations going to actually reach a sort of a real meaningful conclusion? But we are in a information war as well as a threat of a real kinetic war.
And Neil Tabrizi, I wanted to ask you as well, the recent protests, of course, the Iranian government has said that the unrest was being manipulated by Israel and that there have been some reports of Mossad infiltrating Iran. Could you, from what you saw on the ground, was there any indication that some of these protests may have been, in one sense or another, manipulated by outside powers?
No, that is a refrain that we heard, you know, very often. I think it goes back to, you know, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo coming out and telling Iranian protesters, you know, Happy New Year, Mossad is on the streets with you. That I don't, based on the visuals that we were investigating, there's no validity to that statement. If only comments like that from Western leaders make it exceptionally more dangerous for protesters on the ground. When I spoke with people who were protesting on the streets, they said that security forces on, you know, big speakers would say, anyone out on the street is a terrorist, and we're going to respond to you as such. That helps us understand the brutality if the state is going to label civilians out on the streets fighting for a better future as terrorists, and partially because the West is saying, hey, Mossad is there. We need to understand how dangerous that is for protesters.
I wanted to ask you, in the context of history, the Dulles brothers in 1953, John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, head of the CIA and Secretary of State, sending in Teddy Roosevelt's grandson and overthrowing the Democratic elected leader Mohammad Mossadegh, basically on behalf of BP.
Yes.
Right through to now, what it would mean, regime change, and Trump saying, well, he said he was doing it for the protesters if he was to push and actually achieve regime change. Now it's talking about the nuclear program. But we talked to so many activists and academics who are saying, although they are very much against the regime, they don't want the U.S. involved in attacking and removing that regime, that they see this as a popular movement.
This is absolutely a popular movement. I think that is really important. We need to give the agency to the Iranians who are on the streets fighting for a better future. This is absolutely a popular movement. And we can measure that based on the spread, you know, geographically, how many people were involved, and even with the mass arrest, if more than 50,000 people have been arrested, I mean, this points to this being absolutely a grassroots movement.
How many people do you think have died?
Well, these numbers are still in flux, but one of the best documentation groups, Hrana, Human Rights Activist News Agency, they said that just about 7,000, they have confirmed deaths, and there are more than 11,000 under review. They update these tolls daily.
And Professor Keshavarzian, your sense of what the peace movement and those who want to reduce conflict in the world should be doing at this time in terms of Iran?
Yeah, I want to underline what Neelu just said. I mean, I think as progressives in the United States or in the broader outside of Iran, we should be able to hold two truths at the same time. Absolutely, war. U.S. intervention is destructive, it's counterproductive, it hurts actually the most vulnerable in Iran, protesters and others, just like the sanctions have. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge and listen to the large number of Iranians from all different segments and sectors of society that not only this past few months, but for now over 10 years, have been engaging in various forms of protest, whether it's economic issues, whether it's demanding accountability and responsiveness from their rulers. They have been making this demand. And the Islamic Republic's social base has been whittled away gradually but systematically for over the past 15 years. It is vulnerable, but a U.S. intervention is going to be counterproductive to all of this.
Arang Kashivarzian, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Professor of Middle Eastern Islamic Studies at New York University. We hope to have you on soon again. And Nilu Tabrizi, investigative reporter covering Iran, just let go from the Washington Post as part of the massive layoff of more than 300 journalists, about a third of the Washington Post staff. You will both be speaking together on a panel at NYU Wednesday, February 11th. Coming up, we look at why Human Rights Watch blocked a release of a report on the right of return of Palestinians. And we look on the ground at what's happening in Gaza today. Stay with us.
Because the ocean is all around us, and life will flow on as long as there are ripples in the waves and the sun rays from the sun. And while I'm here on earth, I rejoice and swear the freedom is free.
Chicano Batman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with a discussion of Human Rights Watch on the Palestinian right of return. Earlier this week, the two-person Israel-Palestine team at Human Rights Watch announced they're resigning after HRW's new leadership blocked a report which called Israel's denial of Palestinian refugees the right of return a crime against humanity. The team had interviewed 53 refugees in camps across Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon for the stalled report, connecting the expulsions of Palestinians in 1948 all the way to the present moment. Omar Shakir, who headed the team for nearly a decade, and assistant researcher Milena Ansari, in separate resignation letters, suggested the decision to pull the report just before its scheduled publication came from a fear of political backlash. In an email to staff last week, Human Rights Watch's new executive director insisted the disagreement was not over the Palestinian right of return. In a statement sent to Jewish Currents and The Guardian, Human Rights Watch said, quote, "In our review process, we concluded aspects of the research and the factual basis for our legal conclusions needed to be strengthened to meet Human Rights Watch's high standards. For that reason, the publication of the report was paused pending further analysis and research," unquote. For more, we're joined by two guests. Joining us from Amman, Jordan, Omar Shakir just resigned as the Israel-Palestine director at Human Rights Watch. And we're joined by Kenneth Roth, former executive director of Human Rights Watch. He's author of Righting Wrongs, Three Decades on the Front Lines, Battling Abusive Governments. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! We know you've worked together for a long time when Ken was head of Human Rights Watch and Omar, you were head of the Israel-Palestine division. But you differ on that report right now. Omar, I'd like you to start off by saying what you were presenting in this report and why you feel HRW blocked it.
This report was assessing the Israeli government's denial of the right of return on Palestinian refugees. It was coming in the context, of course, of the mass ethnic cleansing and forced displacement of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. The idea here was to connect the erasure of camps in Gaza with the emptying of camps in the West Bank, with the attacks on UNRWA and the longstanding denial of return, and to take stock at this moment where many Palestinians speak of a second Nakba, to understand the lessons of the first one, because the legal architecture of denial of return was not built in 1948. It was built in 1949 to 1952. So we wrote a report and went through the normal Human Rights Watch process. It was signed off by all the relevant departments, including the legal department. It was put on the website, back end of the website. It was translated to multiple languages. External partners were briefed.
And on the eve of its release, our new executive director pulled the report. He provided nothing in writing to explain that decision, and to this date, nothing has been put in writing. And I've done dozens of reports like this, and I've never seen anything like this in the organization's history. But my engagement with senior staffers made very clear that really the overriding concern here was the concern of being seen as challenging a political preference with no basis in international law. The idea of maintaining the Jewishness of the Israeli state, one of course forged through ethnic cleansing and maintained through apartheid. And in this case, that concern trumped calling for the fundamental rights of Palestinians to return to their home. And ultimately, after giving a decade for this organization, I did not feel I could continue to do so when I had lost faith in our new leadership's fidelity to the integrity of what we do best, which is to publish the facts that we document and consistently apply the law.
So, Omar, what you're saying then is that what Human Rights Watch is saying, that, quote, various staff members expressed concern with the report during the review, but that it took the arrival of the new executive director to exert leadership. Were there concerns expressed by other staff previous to your completion of the report?
Look, any report that Human Rights Watch issues, there's going to be concerns raised by different people. But at Human Rights Watch, there's a deference to expertise. And in this case, the report spent 7 months in review. It was signed off on by the Middle East Division, by all experts in their expertise, the Women's Rights Division, the Children's Rights Division, the Refugee Rights Division, the International Justice Division, and the Legal Office, and the Program Office, and it was set for release. And that was over a seven-month process. So were there concerns raised during this time? Yeah, I mean, the program reviewer, when he signed off on the report, said it's a fantastic report, the law's clear, it works well in this format. His one concern was how we can better prepare ourselves to address detractors saying that we're calling to end the Jewish state. And when it went through legal review again, they said this is the correct law, we've applied it before, including in the context of the Chagos Islands in 2023, and the report was signed off on and was slated for release, and we briefed external partners until new leadership came in. And of course, these other concerns bubbled to the surface, and the report was pulled without anything being put in writing. And I should note again that that happened in late November. For the next 6 weeks, I tried very much to engage, and they eventually later said, well, we have some concern about the legal framing. So we offered numerous ways forward that would address the stated legal concerns, including to base the finding on a different crime against humanity, which is transparently clear. And they said, no, that this did not address the concern around advocacy, which had been communicated to me by the chief advocacy officer before as being about the Jewish state. And therefore, they wouldn't even allow edits to be made for the report and to be put back in review. I was told you either narrow the determination in a way that has no basis in fact or law, or the report's not coming out. So I tendered my resignation.
I want to bring Ken Roth into this conversation. Omar, your resignation comes as HRW's new executive director, Philippe Lopian, begins his tenure. Well, the former executive director of Human Rights Watch, Ken Roth, has rejected your claims of politically motivated censorship. He's been quoted in The Guardian and The New York Times and Jewish Currents. He said, quote, that you tried to fast talk through the review system at a time of leadership transition and extreme interpretation of the law that was indefensible. But Ken Roth, you've just arrived in Pakistan right now. Can you explain why you are critical of the report, you who have approved so many of Omar Shakir's reports?
Yes, Amy, good to be here. You know, and it's odd being here because usually I'm lambasted for being too critical of Israel. But, you know, my first principle in dealing with issues of Israel and Palestine is to be scrupulously accurate in applying the facts and the law. And to be honest, you know, if I were still executive director, this report would never have gotten past me. You know, I was always an integral part of the review process. I worked with Omar extensively. The apartheid report that Omar initially drafted, you know, when it came to me, it was utterly unpublishable. And I had to go through three detailed edits before we put out a report that was very strong and that was unimpeachable. The Israeli government didn't know what to do with it. We strengthened the report by making sure that we accurately applied the law and the facts. And that's just not the case here. I mean, the issue here is actually not the right to return. Human Rights Watch has endorsed the right to return for three decades. The issue is whether you call the denial of the right to return a crime against humanity. And that's a brand new theory. There is one case on this point vaguely. by the International Criminal Court in the case of the Rohingya. And it said two things of note. I mean, one is that they can return to their country. It didn't even specify an area. And so, you know, it's unclear in the report, I don't think even addresses this, you know, what is the relevant country here? Is it Palestine or Israel? But more to the point, in the case of the Rohingya, there was extreme suffering. They are not recognized as refugees. They're denied the right to formally work. They can't educate their children in the Bangladeshi system. So this is severe. And the court said in that context, you might rise to the great suffering requirement before you can call a right to return a crime against humanity. Now, can you say that here for the 6 million Palestinian refugees? I mean, you know, many are citizens in Jordan. They're leading ordinary lives. You know, some are in the United States. Is somebody in Detroit, you know, still suffering so greatly that it's a crime against humanity not to let them return? I mean, I happen to be in Lahore, Pakistan right now. You know, at the same time as the Nakba took place of the Palestinians in 1948, here there were 400,000 Hindus and Sikhs who were forcibly expelled. I mean, people would laugh at me if they said it was a crime against humanity that Pakistan is not letting them return now, you know, 70 some years later. So, you know, this is a complicated issue. So when Philippe Lopinion came in, I mean, Omar did benefit from this leadership gap. When he came in and played the role that I would have played, he said, this can't go forward. You can't possibly put forward a report like this, which is just so shoddy in terms of the applying the complicated sets of facts to this brand new legal theory. It's got to go back to the drawing board and be approved, which is exactly what I would have done. So, you know, to say that this is, you know, some big censorship thing is crazy. I mean, it would have been a non-issue if I was there because I would have still been part of the review process. When Philippe arrives and does the same thing, suddenly Omar, you know, wants to fall on his sword and pretend that this is like some great censorship disaster. It isn't. The aim here is to put out a report that is defensible.
You're both lawyers. Omar Shakir, your response.
Look, I mean, Ken is overlooking the fact that Human Rights Watch, in the context of the Chagos Islands in 2023, set out very clearly that denial of return amounts to a crime against humanity. So if what Ken is saying is accurate, that the legal theory is unsupported and untested, Human Rights Watch should do something it's never done in its history, which is to retract that report. It's a matter of consistency for us. If in that report we laid out a legal theory, it has to be applied here. The points that Ken make are actually not the arguments that Human Rights Watch has made. They have made arguments saying, well, you know, the factual research could be much stronger because everything that Ken laid out regarding the harm of the Rohingya in Myanmar, you have with Palestinians. Let's remember, you have generations of refugees, you know, fathers and grandfathers that live their life as refugees, that don't have the right to work, that don't have citizenship, that face restrictions on all aspects of their everyday life. And it stems at root from the fact that the Israeli government denies them the right to return to their homeland, disconnects them, severs them, the anguish of being disconnected from your land. And by the way, we heard these testimonies from Palestinians in Gaza who are now in Egypt, who wanted to return amid a genocide to their land, to their streets, to their neighborhoods. Imagine that pain over the course of many, many generations. That anguish clearly meets the threshold of a crime against humanity. And let's remember, I mean, Ken hasn't read the report. We wouldn't even cite Ken's testimony in a report because it's all secondhand and it's not based on having seen the report directly. Here, the difference between when Ken was executive director is he would read a report, he would make comments, we would have a back and forth like we had here, and we would arrive at a good place. In this particular case, you know, Philippe came in, he made a decision, nothing was put in writing, there was no chance to directly engage. We offered to make edits to address any concerns, including to base it on a separate crime against humanity of persecution, which is straightforward, severe abuse of fundamental rights with a discriminatory intent. Right of return is fundamental, it's severe, it's multiple generations, and it's discriminatory. Jewish citizens of other countries can go to Israel and become citizens. And we were told nothing about the law at that point. The only argument was the advocacy concerns. And that's really the key point here. Amy, Human Rights Watch's credibility is we release our reports no matter what they are. We did it on October 7th, even though there wasn't a really good advocacy strategy because the leaders that carried out those attacks, the crimes against humanity, were being killed. We released a report on Al-Ahli Hospital in November 2023 where there was no advocacy strategy and it wasn't determinative. We released my FBI report on the Rabaa massacre in Egypt, even though it shut our office down in Egypt, because the principal thing to do is you publish the research when it's ready. But in this case, Human Rights Watch was unwilling to do so, and it comes at its core because the right of return remains this third rail, even among progressive human rights institutions. This was the first report in Human Rights Watch's history that looks holistically at the plight of Palestinian refugees, and it's the first time that a decision like this is made to shelve a report on its eve because of concerns about pragmatism, and simply, I couldn't continue when I felt these decisions were not being rooted in our normal methodology and were letting certain voices and certain political preference trump fundamental rights.
Ken Roth, I'm wondering if you could respond, but also if you could talk about what kind of pressure Human Rights Watch has been under from Israel in prior reports that you've produced.
Yeah, well, I mean, I should say that, I mean, you know, Human Rights Watch is always under pressure for whatever we say in Israel. That's just par for the course. I mean, I have an entire chapter in my book on this. You just live with it. It doesn't really matter. You know, Human Rights Watch, as I noted, has always endorsed the right to return. So, you know, there's no greater, you know, pressure on us. Now, I don't think anybody even knew this report was coming. So there was zero pressure on this report. You know, what Omar is outlining, though, is precisely why Philippe was right to send this back to the drawing board, because, you know, some Palestinian refugees may indeed have this great suffering required for it to be a crime against humanity, but a lot of them clearly don't. And that's, from my understanding, is not the nuance that the report introduced to suggest that all 6 million Palestinian refugees get to go back to Israel, that, you know, that they're all suffering so severely that this is a crime against humanity if they don't. Or separately, you know, could the crime against humanity be satisfied by going to Palestine, you know, the West Bank or Gaza, rather than Israel? I mean, I don't know. But these are the kinds of complexities that need to be addressed rather than just rush through a 33-page report, which just is not long enough, is not detailed enough, doesn't have enough research to get into these complexities to make a compelling case. That's why I never would have allowed this report to get through the review process.
We just have 20 seconds, Omar Shakir from Amman, your final comment.
Look, I think it says something very clear that two former Human Rights Watch staffers are having a discussion about the integrity of the work and the future of the organization. Where is Philippe Loupion?
Omar Shakir, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Omar has just resigned as Israel-Palestine director at Human Rights Watch after HRW blocked a report which called Israel's denial of the right of return for Palestinians a crime against humanity. And Kenneth Roth, former executive director of Human Rights Watch. That does it for our show. On Monday, February 23rd, Democracy Now! Will be celebrating our 30th anniversary at Riverside Church with Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, Maria Ressa, Michael Stipe, Wynton Marsalis, and many others. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We hope to see you there. Go to democracynow.org for information.
You are listening to WRCT, Pittsburgh. 88.3 FM.